So trust in mind. We're going to get a lot more intimate with it today. At least that's the aspiration. But before we look at the first six stanzas of Sung San's Xin Xin Ming, or Trust in Mind, I'd like to take just a minute to talk about Taoism in general and Wu Wei in particular, which Sung San brings up often in his poem. Yesterday, we talked about the blending of Indian Buddhism and Chinese Taoism. There's also a little bit of Confucianism in there too, but it's mostly that created Chan, but it's mostly Buddhism and Taoism. Some of the things that Taoism brought into Indian Buddhism: spontaneity, simplicity, the practice of Wu Wei, that is harmonizing with the natural order of things. Life lived in balance with nature in order to bring about inner peace. If you haven't looked into Taoism much, you might not be so familiar with Wu Wei. But it's a key teaching in Taoism that absolutely suited Chinese Buddhism beautifully. Wu Wei is about finding equanimity and a flow. So action is without striving or stridency, without imposing ourselves, but by finding our groove in the natural order of things, which is the Tao, the way. It does not mean being passive or lazy. It means intuiting the right activity, the right action, by seeing and becoming the natural flow of things. For an example of how to do this, we can look to nature for guidance. Like water that flows naturally around obstacles and sometimes even wears them away. You want to check me on this? Go take a look at the Grand Canyon. Water did that. Water that's able to take the shape of whatever container it's resting in without ever losing or changing its character. Nature reflects the Tao to us. Through it, we can see the interconnectedness of all things, and we can see that things are always changing. We aspire to act in ways that are in harmony with all this, with the way of the universe. And that's with our own true nature, all the same. Wu Wei teaches us to let go of our need to control, which in the end is going to be fruitless anyway, right? You know that. And instead wisely respond in an effortless, genuine, unaffected way to each moment as it arises, to each situation as it arises. Perhaps you've heard of the book Zen and the Art of Archery. It's one of a number of books and practices that center on Wu Wei. Also, a word about the word Tao, the way. Chinese characters, you know, writing, not the neighborhood eccentrics, have a lot of ambiguity, which might be one of the reasons that Chinese poetry is so beautiful. The character for Tao, for example, has two main parts. Shu meaning head or leader, but it can also mean origin or source. And Chu, representing movement, implying a dynamic, ongoing process. It kind of looks like a foot taking a step. Together, they symbolize way or path. This path is the fundamental governing principle of the universe. Origin of all things being this dynamic, ongoing process. What's the Buddhist word for much of this? Dharma. Not an exact equivalent, because Dharma has many meanings, including the teachings of the Buddha. But Dharma includes much of what's expressed by Tao. The Tao includes reality, the way things are, just like this, the way things work, and the way of living in harmony with the natural world. The Tao is the source, the nourishment, the ideal state of things. It's what's real. A universal force present in all things, and in the end, beyond our logical understanding. We can't get there by thinking it through or talking it through. The Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. That's the very first line of the great Taoist text by Lao Tzu, the Tao Te Ching, which means the book of the way and its power, or the way in its virtue. I think this pretty much all sounds like Zen to us. And we're learning to live according to these values by practicing meditation and mindfulness and equanimity. Okay, that's it. Yesterday, when we read the Trust in Mind poem in its entirety, we heard how the third ancestor, Sung San, experienced oneness for himself. I think it's safe to say that while the circumstances of waking up manifest for each of us in a way that's particular to each of us, that in this experience of oneness, it's the same for everyone. And the Trust in Mind is Sung San's virtuoso attempt at giving us a description of his experience, his personal awakening. Clearly, he shows us his attainment of the Four Noble Truths, the first three of the Four Noble Truths anyway. Life is full of uneasiness. We ourselves cause this dissatisfaction, this uneasiness in our lives by grasping an aversion, by clinging to our likes and dislikes. And finally, because we cause the problem, we have it in our power to fix it. The Trust in Mind shows us Sung San's experience that it is duality, that grasping and aversion, liking and disliking, judging, that clouds our view and prevents us from seeing clearly the truth of the unity of all things and beings. He begins by saying, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." So wonderfully encouraging. When love and hate or grasping and aversion are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. The way to wake up, Sung San tells us, let go of our attachment to duality. Seems clear enough. And the Buddha told us that every single one of us willing to put in the effort can wake up. But I have to say, when I first read this stanza the first time, it stopped me right there. I thought, what does he mean? When both love and hate are absent, everything becomes clear. I've always thought love was a good thing. But as you go on reading, you realize that what he's talking about, his real point, is not getting stuck in opposites. Most of you, or at least many of you, will remember that Sung San, De Sun's name, called relative world, the world of the 10,000 things, opposites world. The other half of the Zen circle being absolute world, the world of one, of emptiness, wholeness. But they're not really separate, are they? All things are one, but they are also two. Every single phenomenon comprises the one, and the one comprises every single phenomenon. You know the three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance? I recently heard a teacher call them the three virtues. What did he mean by that? I think he meant that something like anger isn't always bad, isn't always poison. It can teach us, maybe. You can use it like a scalpel to cut away bullshit, but you have to use it in a skillful way. You know, everyone wants definitions, clear definitions, to box something up so it can be set aside, all taken care of. But we learn pretty quick, don't we, that things don't work that way. Like, we're all familiar with greed. I want something and I want it now, like enlightenment maybe. And ignorance, that can be a wonderful motivator, a very creative place. If you see it with wisdom and without judging, when we recognize our ignorance of our true self and we begin to have some insight into non-self and impermanence, recognizing our ignorance can be a wonderful motivator to look more deeply into our practice. And love, well, I'm guessing you've all seen Fatal Attraction. Love might not always be a good thing. It can be used to smother people, jealousy, possessiveness, things like that. So these are words. They're ideas we created. What counts is how we meet situations, what we do. If we're able to be skillful in what we do, when we find ourselves experiencing greed, anger, and ignorance about how we respond. We have to look at our own nature and see that all the things we meet are just as they are. And we are too. Recognize that, come to terms with it, and neither grasp these things nor push them away. Just see them and then see how we can use them skillfully, beneficially, if we can. How? These skillful ways, skillful means, begin with our bodhisattva intention to bring all beings to a sense of ease in this world. Living means functioning, right? And when we function, we're going to be either skillful or not. We're going to be beneficial or not, maybe harmful. I think we wouldn't be here if we didn't want to be beneficial to ourselves and others and the whole planet. This functioning shows itself as our encounters with the things of the world in their suchness, their lack of a separate abiding self, the thing just as it is. What we encounter is just what we encounter in and of itself. If someone's hungry, what do we do? If someone is angry, what do we do? If something of use is broken, a table, what do we do? Maybe throw it out. Maybe fix it. We have choices then, and our bodhisattva vow is there to be the determining factor in making those kinds of choices. We start then with the first of the Eightfold Path, right view or appropriate view, and we turn it into right or appropriate action. Action, not theories. Letting go of preferences, again, is not about apathy or passivity. It's about nurturing, not attachment and acceptance. Seeing, recognizing preferences and aversions when they arise, seeing them without judgment, and then with the awareness we've been cultivating, making the choice to let go of our attachment to them. What happens then? Then we're more flexible, adaptable. We have a more profound appreciation for our lives, for each moment as it is. We open ourselves to the possibility that other ways of seeing things are equally valid to our own. That there might be beauty in other outcomes. In other words, we don't have to cling to getting things our own way. We're also freer of the need to seek external validation, you know, pats on the head for getting it right. We grow. So the song goes on. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are infinitely set apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. So this indeed is going to require some effort. We're talking about a big radical transformation of our view of things. But if we can do it, if we can stop our knee-jerk reactions based on what we like and what we don't like, then we can live a life of freshness, spontaneity and creativity, kindness and gratitude. We meet each moment as it is, and we see our correct function in that moment. This is talking about attaining emptiness, attaining not self, attaining oneness. When we see not self and emptiness, we start to figure out why all the longing, grasping, and judging bring us pain. We start to get wise. Our equanimity grows. Like with love and hate, both require a lot of damn energy, right? But it's our mindfulness of them that determines whether that energy is healthy and honest. What's being said here is that getting rid of likes and dislikes means encountering all things, not grasping or rejecting anything, just experiencing, seeing, functioning. Not aching for things to always go the way we want. Sun Tzu isn't offering a set of rules for his folks down at the Zendo. No, he's offering a way, an alternative for everyone to live day to day with awareness and clarity. We're not trying to force things or get our two cents in. We're aspiring to roll with the punches, swim with the current, not passively at all, but using some wisdom, you know, Wu Wei, acting without acting. Because if there's no separate permanent self to act, then in the natural flow of things, the action just acts itself skillfully. Again, clearly, this is not about passivity. Sun San says, to set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. So our cultures and our families and our own psychology have all contributed to making us who we are. They've constructed us, as it were. It's our karma. Conditioned us to be who we are, made our self-identity. And for most people, their view of the world is filtered through this self-identity. So when anything new comes along, it gets tested against the likes and dislikes that developed over time. This causes confusion and delusion. But even so, when we start to grasp the nature of the self, non-self, and the nature of emptiness, inner being, when our lives become refreshed by the two truths, we begin to tear down that formidable structure we've built. And we start to see things with a fresh eye. We start to see how and why longing, clinging, rejecting all contribute to our lack of ease. Like maybe something as simple as when we meet a new person. And as our sense of equanimity grows, we start to demolish our need to react to these things based on our preferences. We've brought strong medicine to this disease of the mind. We become aware of our freedom. Again, this is not meant to tell us not to value our own ethics, or as much as possible, the ethics of our culture. The Buddha and Sung San are not guiding us to turn into slugs. I don't mean to defame slugs. The disease of the mind he's talking about is that constant chatter going on in our heads, which when we look, we discover has a great deal to do with what we like and what we don't like. Don't worry about it. The chatter is natural. He's talking about attachment to the chatter, or believing the chatter going on in our heads as a basis for reality. The deep meaning he refers to is seeing not self, is emptiness. Then Sung San says, the way is perfect like vast space where nothing is lacking and nothing in excess. Indeed, it is due to our choosing to accept or reject that we do not see the true nature of things. The way is perfect like vast space. Wonderful. Sung San couldn't have made it clearer. The way is perfect like vast space. This chatter we're talking about too often convinces us that things have a permanent reality, a separate permanent reality, and that they're desirable or undesirable. We end up seeing only our idea about them rather than the reality of them. We don't see what's really going on. So we get out there and try to shore things up with ideas or material possessions. Listen to this poem by Ryokan. The thief left it behind, the moon at my window. Pristine look at the beauty of a moment in time and a reminder to wake up to what is there. See the richness of what the moment offers, no matter how familiar. Be present, be here now. When we walk the way, when we experience emptiness, experience our own Buddha nature, we let go of our need to have everything as we think it ought to be. Something we're never going to get. We try to connect with harmony where we can. We don't feel like something is lacking. We don't feel like things are out of whack or too much. Our sense of ease increases as our likes and dislikes quietly slip away. This isn't some Pollyanna paradise Sun Sun is talking about. There's nothing abstract about it. It's a sense of balance, nothing more. Heaven and earth are no longer set apart. Heaven and earth are states of mind, right? Things are no longer out of balance because what creates our state of mind now that we see is wisdom, is compassion, and clear seeing. How do we get there? Sun Tzu might have mentioned, stop having likes and dislikes. Stop picking and choosing. Embrace your whole life. Birds follow their own nature. Rain follows its own nature. We can too. Even when faced with the vast complexity of our lives, we just have to try 10,000 years. Sun Tzu continues, live neither in the entanglements of outer things nor in inner feelings of emptiness. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. Again, more encouragement. And he knows because he's seen it. Live neither in entanglements outside nor feelings of emptiness inside. Be serene in the unity of all things, and erroneous views will disappear on their own. So Goddess knows there are plenty of outer entanglements with which we must deal day in and day out. And we get the internal chatter that comes with it. Most of it urging us to choose among a carnival of preferences, depending on whether there's joy in something shiny or sadness in something we don't want in the vicinity. Sometimes the results bore them either way. We can get so much stuff, and if we want, we can usually get next day delivery. And yet, the alienation we so often find ourselves confronted with lets us know that whatever it was, it just wasn't enough. We can do the same thing to ourselves when we go in search of quiet and inner peace. Real silence, the experience of silence, isn't in search of anything. It just allows our spaciousness of mind to flourish. Thoughts and feelings come and quietly go. No clinging, no alienation. We find the whole, we find oneness, we find the Tao. This is things as they are, right here, right now. My cat, Fintan, can sit still, not move a muscle, maybe blink for a very long time. But when he's done doing that, he just gets up and takes a walk or comes over to me and suggests that I feed him. He's not concerned in the least with the quality of his sitting. Although I must say he's very good at it. Sometimes after a nice sit, he just takes a nap. He's following his way, the cat way, with no hindrance. He takes no view on the quality of the panorama out the window. It was the view at hand. He knows what's what. When the Buddha spoke of right view as the first of the Eightfold Path, he meant our understanding of the Four Noble Truths. He meant no view beyond that, no preconceived view. And again, Sun Tzu says, when you try to stop activity by passivity, your very effort fills you with activity. As long as you remain in one extreme or the other, you will never know oneness. Again, so simple and clear. Oneness is attained when all our self-consciousness disappears and we act, or perhaps don't act, spontaneously and naturally. We don't struggle to do something, neither do we struggle against doing something. In other words, we don't try to control things. We just let them be. So again, Sun Tzu is urging us to see the importance of letting go of all dualistic thinking, our likes and dislikes, all the distinctions our minds create, often out of thin air. He's making it clear we're not rocks or plaster statues. We are living beings, and and trying to let our lives slither by passively in order not to pick and choose what we have to do, not to pick and choose an action, is not at all what he's talking about. That's not Wu Wei. Rather, having equanimity provides us with a balance to our relentless self-centeredness. And practicing Wu Wei, acting without acting, is not about doing nothing. It's about skillful choice, a state of serenity that lets us do our best, but not cling to an outcome that we insist on. Instead, we let things unfold with the current conditions and causes. Someone has called that dynamic stillness. Isn't that great? Those who choose to live through Wu Wei might be politicians or great teachers or scientists or parents who are able to act with the natural flow of things. They are the ones who display an intuitive understanding of what is true without resorting only to the intellect. People who can say, what I do in, day in and day out, it's quite ordinary, no big thing, but I'm in total harmony with it. They're at ease with their own minds, not holding on to anything, not rejecting anything. They've experienced oneness. At the same time, Sung San is calling on us to be aware that waking up isn't about getting anything. Set up a nice shiny enlightenment and go after it. Wrestle that damn enlightenment to the ground. Nope. He's saying, let go of all dualities. And that includes enlightenment and delusion, passive and active, good and bad, right and wrong. Cut off all likes and dislikes, and the way will become as clear and vast as the vistas you can see through mountain air. Approach situations without preconceptions, without judgment, without attachment to your own view. Experience the world as it truly is, an undivided unity, a oneness, and then deal with whatever's at hand. Thank you so much for your generous, patient listening. We'll take up the next six stanzas tomorrow. Have a clear afternoon.